Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Aruki Uran, your host for today's engaging conversation. We have the pleasure of speaking with Vladimir Hamed Troyansky about his fascinating new book, Empire of Refugees, North Caucasian Muslims and the Late Ottoman State. The book is freshly released this February of 2024 by Stanford University Press. And to be honest, I've eagerly anticipated this book for over a year, and making today's interview is a true honor. Before we dive into our discussion, let me introduce our distinguished guest, Dr. Vladimir Hamed Troyansky, a renowned historian specializing in global migration and forced displacement, currently serves as an assistant professor of global studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Hamed Troyansky. It is truly an honor to have you here with us.
Aruki, thank you very much for this generous introduction. It is such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Before we dive deep into the fascinating discussions about your book, I was wondering if you could share a bit about yourself with our listeners. I think it would be wonderful to hear about your journey and experiences that have influenced your current research and what has led you to focus on the themes of migration and displacement?
Thank you. I'm a historian of migration and displacement in the Russian and Ottoman empires. So how did this book come about? Many years ago, I did my undergraduate degree in Scotland at St. Andrews, and I spent a year studying Arabic in Syria and in Egypt. That was before the Arab Spring. And when I was living in Damascus, I first heard about the Circassian diaspora in Syria and the Chechen diaspora and the Dagestani diaspora. I was born in the Soviet Union, so I had some idea about what happened in the Caucasus in the 19th century. But it was really in Syria when I understood the legacy of displacement and of Tsarist violence today. So that's how I first got interested in shared histories of the Caucasus and of the Middle East. And then I started my PhD studies at Stanford, and I had Arabic and Russian. I started studying Ottoman Turkish and modern Turkish. And when it came time for me to choose a dissertation topic, it happened naturally. I wanted to work on migration, on hidden histories connecting the two empires, Ottoman and Russian. And I was struck that there was not enough literature in English about Muslim displacement from Russia to the Middle East. So 10 years later, here's this beautiful book, Empire of Refugees, and hopefully it will lead to new conversations and to new research in the two fields, the field of Russian and Caucasus history and Ottoman and Middle Eastern history.
That sounds incredible. And your journey truly sounds fascinating. And it seems it definitely paved the way for this creation of this incredible work, Empire of Refugees. Could you share some insights about the themes and key arguments presented in your book? What is this book about? What are we dealing with here?
Of course. So the book is a history of migration. It tells the story of about a million Muslim refugees from the Russian Empire who arrived in the Ottoman Empire between the mid-19th century and World War I. Let me provide key facts about the story, and then I'll go into more detail. In the second half of the 19th century, there was a prolonged refugee crisis with Muslims leaving the Caucasus for the Ottoman Empire. And the reasons for displacement were many, but they all stemmed from Russian conquest and occupation of the Caucasus. And people from practically every ethnic group in the North Caucasus were emigrating. Western Circassians, Kabardians, Abazians, Karachais, Balkars, Chechens, Ingush, Ossetians, various groups in Dagestan, like Avars, Dargins, Kumiks, and Laks. That emigration cut across socioeconomic lines as well. We have Kabardian princely families, wealthy landowners, free peasants, enslaved people. There was emigration to the Middle East across the board. The Ottoman government welcomed refugees from the Caucasus and resettled them throughout the empire in territories of today's 14 nation states in the Middle East and the Balkans. The largest North Caucasian diaspora today is in Turkey, where it's between 2 and 3 million people, the second largest ethnic minority after the Kurds, and also fairly large diasporas in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Israel. And in this book, I'm examining migration policies of the Russian and the Ottoman empires and their effects on demographic, society, and economy. And I'm also looking at the formation of the North Caucasian diaspora in the Middle East.
It's fascinating, and I think it's incredible themes that we will be discussing in this interview. But also, just to set the stage for our listeners and delve kind of into this heart of these great themes that you're working and kind of try to provide in this book, could you just set an overview of the historical and geographical context? I mean, specifically, I'm curious about the time period we're focusing on and the geographical boundaries that defined Russian and Ottoman empires during this era under discussion. It seems like, what are the boundaries? It seems the fluidity is going on. How do these settings play into the narrative you're presenting in this work?
Of course. So we're looking at two massive empires, Russia and the Ottoman Empire. By the 1860s, both were very close to their largest territorial extent ever. The Ottomans already started losing territories in the Balkans since the 18th century. Meanwhile, Russia has not yet occupied everything that it will in Central Asia and the Pacific region. So for the Ottomans, they ruled over much of the Balkans, except Greece, entire Anatolia, modern-day Turkey, the Levant, modern-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, and Israel, and also Iraq, parts of the Arabian Peninsula, and parts of North Africa. The Russian Empire, which will be more familiar to many listeners, had this massive territory from Poland across Ukraine into the Urals and Siberia. Now in the Caucasus, territories south of the mountains, so today Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, were already part of the Russian Empire. Meanwhile, some regions to the north of the mountains, which is the North Caucasus within the Russian Federation today, had not yet been occupied by the Russian Empire. Between 1817 and 1864, Russia waged a series of military campaigns against indigenous Muslim communities in the North Caucasus, which we know today as the Caucasus War. And that war was incredibly brutal. In the last stages of the war, in the early 1860s, the Russian army perpetrated an ethnic cleansing on the Circassian coast. And there are many contemporary accounts of the atrocities, and they're truly horrifying. An indigenous Circassian Muslim population was expelled. In only 2 years, 1863 and 1864, up to 500,000 Circassians became refugees. That was up to 90% of the entire Western Circassian population. Since the 1990s, many Circassian activists outside of Russia and in the North Caucasus called for the recognition of those events as a genocide. So this moment of expulsion, the end of the Caucasus War, is very important in both Russian and Ottoman histories. It was one of the largest displacements in Russian imperial history, and that expulsion changed everything in the region. It solidified Russia's control over the entire Caucasus region. And of course, it dramatically transformed the demographics in the region. After 1864, the settler colonial project is in full swing in the Caucasus. Meanwhile, for the Ottomans, it was the largest refugee crisis that the Ottoman Empire had ever experienced. For the Ottomans, this migration also changed everything. The Ottoman Empire, and this is a central argument in the book, The Ottoman government built an entire refugee regime responding to the arrival of Muslim refugees from Russia. And so then, after the Caucasus War, emigration continued for the next half century when the Caucasus was already fully within the Russian Empire.
This, I think, really brings us to an interesting point about the scale of this work, because, like, given these vast territories that you have described right now, which is really complex to work with, I think, and encompassing two empires, it has fluid borders, diverse imperial interests, I assume, and multitude of ethnic groups that you have listed. And your task of kind of weaving together these complex narratives, it truly seems monumental. And your extensive archival work, kind of spanning over like 20 private and public archives across countries like Jordan, Turkey, Bulgaria, Georgia, the UK, Russia, and it seems even within the autonomous North Caucasus republics of like Kabardino-Balkaria, North Ossetia, Alanya, and Dagestan. And it is incredibly impressive. Could you share with us how you navigated the challenges of researching and writing about such diverse and it seems even dispersed group of refugees? And what strategies did you employ to bring coherence to their stories across such kind of varied and dynamic landscapes?
Well, thank you. Clearly, I couldn't stop doing archival research for this book. It's based on archival research in 10 countries. And when it comes to archives in the former Russian Empire, I'm really grateful that I got to spend time not only in state archives in Moscow, but also in three very important archives in the North Caucasus, in Nalchi, Kablazikavkaz, and Mahashkala, and also three national archives in the South Caucasus, in Tbilisi, Yerevan, and Baku. And for me, it was also very important to provide not only the state perspective on migration and resettlement, but also to seek out refugees' voices, to show how refugees experience displacement. So it is a history of migration from above by looking at the migration policies, but it's also a history of migration from below. So I used several types of evidence to bring out refugees' experiences of migration. Over the years, I collected many private letters that refugees wrote to their families in the Caucasus or exchanged within the Ottoman Empire. Those letters are usually in Ottoman Turkish and Arabic, which are the main written languages for the North Caucasian refugees at this time. Some of them are in the state archives, and some of them are in private collections in the Middle East. I published an article in Slavic Review in 2023 titled Letters from the Ottoman Empire. And that article examines how these letters were being secretly sent back and forth across the Russo-Ottoman border. But in addition to letters, I looked at petitions. There are many petitions that North Caucasians sent to the Russian government before their emigration, and then to the Ottoman government during the resettlement period. I also interviewed descendants of North Caucasian refugees in Jordan and Turkey about how their families remember Ottoman resettlement, right? Mm-hmm. And those recollections very much supplement the archival findings about their family histories.
I think that considering this intricate work of just, you know, piecing together the stories of refugees, and you do mention that it often appear as muted figures within imperial records, and sometimes even kind of overshadowed by this like broad categorizations. And it's fascinating how you managed to bring their narrative to the forefront. In doing so, you kind of really highlight the concept of hijra, right, as this central to their experiences. And while bringing their voices forefront with this book, could you unpack this concept of hijra for our listeners? I mean, I'm particularly interested how this concept influenced the refugees and their understanding of their migration and resettlement, and just in general, what role it played in their collective and individual identities when you were reading these letters, when you were reading these petitions, when you were just hearing their voices. How did they imagine this refugee resettlement?
Absolutely. So Let's talk about the terminology first. Hijra is the term for the journey of the Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina in the 7th century. It's a very important event in early Islamic history, and it's the start of the Hijri of the Islamic calendar. Someone who is undertaking the Hijra is called Muhajir, and this term originally was used for the companions of the Prophet Muhammad who undertook this journey with him to preserve their faith, Islam. Throughout Islamic history, Muslim communities that had been expelled, who had to flee their homelands, also used this term, Muhajir, in emulation of the Prophet's companions. When we get to the 19th century, this term, there's a revival of this term. It's widely used because it's so salient. So many regions across the Muslim world were occupied by the European empires, and there was so much displacement. So Muslims who had to flee the European occupations and found refuge in Muslim countries, especially mm-hmm. in the Ottoman Empire, called themselves Muhajirs. So in the case of North Caucasians, they almost exclusively used the term Muhajir to describe themselves. And so did the Ottoman government. And actually, so did the Russian government also often used that term, repeating it, because North Caucasian refugees used it so much. Hijra was really important for the North Caucasian migration. Many refugees describe their migration as hijra, especially refugees from the North Central and Northeastern Caucasus. And I saw quite a few private letters in which Chechen, Kabardian, and Dagestani refugees tell their relatives, still in the Caucasus, that hijra is honorable, that it's the obligation of good Muslims to emigrate to the Ottoman Empire because they shouldn't stay in Russia. And at the time, so the last half century of Russian imperial rule, there was a debate about hijra in the Caucasus, whether Russian Muslims had an obligation to emigrate to preserve their faith. For example, the Russian government-appointed ulama, or the religious elites, they understandably were more likely to say no. Russia remains Dar al-Islam, or the domain of peace. Muslims should stay here. And many educators were also urging people to stay because they knew what a terrible toll emigration would take on the people and on the communities left behind. Meanwhile, many others, especially the kind of local imams, they were more likely to say that Russia, after Tsarist conquests in the Caucasus, was Dar al-Harb, the domain of war. So Hijra was a religious necessity. On the Ottoman side of the border, the language of Hijra was hugely important. It helped many North Caucasian refugees to find support and sympathy from the Ottoman government and also from host Muslim populations, because Hijra is such an important event in Islamic history. Being a Muhajir meant sacrificing so much to preserve your faith. It was widely understood as a noble and tragic thing to do. And I want to be clear here that in the 19th and 20th centuries, Hijra was hardly ever voluntary. It was usually a result of ethnic cleansing or genocide or dispossession. And the religious aspect of one's journey, of one's Hijra, was often emphasized post factum, later. So I would say that it was often a way of dealing with trauma of displacement, trying to make sense of horrendous things that refugees had experienced and placing themselves, Muslims from the Caucasus, within a long lineage of Muslims through history who had to flee. So in that sense, Hijra helped refugees to find comfort in being part of Islamic history and part of the global Muslim community, which was a hugely important sentiment at a time when parts of the Muslim world were being occupied and colonized by the European empires.
It's interesting, like speaking of Hijra and their experiences, like on this micro level, they do kind of view this whole movement process as a religious obligation or religious phenomenon. And it brings me to wonder about this like macro level of this story, like how empires are viewing these refugees, especially as we delve into this, like inter-imperial exchanges, like particularly the movements of Circassian Muslims to the Ottoman Empire, Christians to the Russian Empire, it becomes evident how these kind of migrations shaped each empire's policies and even conceptualizations of what it means to be a refugee or an imperial subject, right? Could you shed light on these categories and criteria that were pivotal in shaping Russia's and Ottoman Empire's migration policies? And I mean, how do these categories in a way influence their understanding and treatment of refugees at their kind of sense of what is to be imperial subject or the sense of imperial subjecthood?
Right. So Russia's and Ottoman migration policies towards Muslim refugees cannot seem more different. But at the same time, they both serve the same goal, to strengthen imperial control over their territories. And they had many shared elements, right? You know, the zeitgeist. So let's focus on religion, right? Religion was the central category in migration policies of the two empires. To start with Russia, the Tsarist government perceived one's faith to likely determine their loyalty to the empire. And in Russia's religious hierarchy, Orthodox Christians occupied the top position, followed by other Christians, then by Muslims and Jews, and then by all others. When we look at the demographics in Tsarist Caucasus, most emigrants to the Ottoman Empire were Muslims, and most immigrants from the rest of the Russian Empire and from the Ottoman Empire were Christians. Russia made specific policies to encourage the immigration of Christian settlers, and it was pretty specific about their being Christian. Russia also passed exclusionary migration laws for non-Christians. So, for example, there was when people wanted to emigrate from the empire, they were signing statements consenting to their being eternally banned from returning to Russia. And the statement, which was an eternal ban, it was required of North Caucasian Muslims, Crimean Tatar Muslims, and Jewish populations in the Pale of Settlement. It was never really asked of Christian communities. So that religious bias was baked in. Now, in the Ottoman Empire, the situation was reverse. Most immigrants were Muslims, specifically Muslims from Russia and from the Balkans, and most emigrants were Christians, either to Russia or to the Americas. And religion was a central category in what I call the Ottoman refugee regime. So between 1860 and World War I, the Ottoman government constructs a Muslim refugee regime. What is a refugee regime? It's a set of principles, norms, and procedures governing the acceptance and the resettlement of refugees. When we talk about refugee regimes, we usually talk about the 20th century, the League of Nations, the United Nations,
right,
the 1951 Refugee Convention, like very international secular refugee regimes.
Right.
What I'm showing in this book, that in the second half of the 19th century, a Muslim country, the Ottoman Empire, was offering something that was remarkably similar to refugee protections one might expect today. And at the core of that refugee regime was the Ottoman responsibility to protect Muslims, because the Ottoman Sultan was also a caliph or political successor to the Prophet Muhammad. And as a caliph, there was that assumed responsibility to protect Muslims wherever they lived. So by the second half of the 19th century, as the Ottoman Empire is shrinking on all sides, the Ottomans are deploying that rhetoric for their internal and external legitimacy and to project soft power into the Muslim world. It was a regime of expectations. It was international to a certain extent, because many Muslims living outside of the Ottoman Empire, they knew that they could find safety, that they would be welcomed in the Ottoman Empire, that they could qualify for certain benefits, right? Because the Ottomans were caliphs, because it was their responsibility to protect. And speaking of the benefits, this regime came with a strong welfare package. The refugees were guaranteed free land, exemptions from taxation and military service, financial aid, all kinds of subsidies to set up their farms. But the most important thing was really the guarantee of admission for any Muslim who required help. Meanwhile, the Ottomans, they also had an open door policy for others, for non-Muslims. But Muslim refugees were guaranteed admission no matter what. By the late 19th century, non-Muslims, foreign Christians and Jews from the Russian Empire and from Romania, they could immigrate in the Ottoman Empire, but their admission was no longer guaranteed. So, for example, Zionist organizations had to negotiate with the Ottoman government the terms of the admission of Jewish immigrants. So there was a strong sectarian logic developing on both sides in Russia and the Ottoman Empire, that one's religious identity correlated to one's loyalty to a specific empire. For Muslims, to the Ottoman Empire, for Christians, to Russia. And I think this idea of loyalty is a very important category by itself. And it was very much mixed up together with religion. And that is a very dangerous logic in nationalizing empires, in borderlands. And that logic, it eventually leads to horrendous things, to the genocide of Armenians, Assyrians, and Greeks in Ottoman Anatolia in the 1910s, in war crimes and displacement of Muslims in the Balkans in the same time period, and then the Greek-Turkish population exchange in 1923.
On a related note about this Ottoman Empire regime and refugee regime and the idea of loyalty and a sense of, as you said, safety, right? How they viewed or their regime or how the rhetoric was kind of constructed. And just because moving from this broader imperial dynamics to this intimate narratives on the ground, how was it really playing out? And you fascinatingly unfold the story of this of the Khutat family, who emigrated to the Ottoman Empire in 1880s and 1890s. And the story not only personalizes this historical account, but also offers kind of insights into the resettlement of North Caucasian refugees in Anatolia. How did this resettlement process impact the cultural and religious identities of the Khutat family and others like them, right? In what ways their new surroundings influence their sense of self and community? Can you talk about this this family and the story that you are presenting in this book?
Thank you for asking this. The story of the Khutat family is fascinating, and I'm so grateful to this family that is now split between Jordan and Turkey that allowed me to tell this story.
Wow.
So what I have is this unique set of documents, a collection of 58 private letters that one Circassian family exchanged between 1890 and 1905.
Beautiful. Wow.
And they preserved, like all these, of all these years, they preserved these magnificent letters in Ottoman Turkish, kept in Amman. And through these letters, through family photographs, through their genealogical trees and follow-up interviews, I reconstruct a family history of the Khutats, of Circassian notables who became refugees and who were searching for a perfect place of resettlement in the Ottoman Empire. And so in their quest for this perfect place, they were in Istanbul at some point, then they were in Adana in southern Anatolia, then they were in central Anatolia, and finally they moved to Amman and Jordan. And so you asked me about the methodological issues of what it's like to write a history when there's a grand narrative, but also stories of individual families. So in this in chapter five in the book, I combine the discussion of the Khutat family with the discussion of North Caucasian resettlement in central Anatolia, and with what kinds of challenges refugees faced in Anatolia. And I'm giving context of this one family's decisions, whether to stay or to leave, to buy property, to educate children privately. And that family's story adds a lot of nuance to showing how many other people navigated their resettlement. I'm also showing in that story, through those letters, that connections mattered so much during resettlement, and that more privileged refugees had access to better knowledge about migration and resettlement, and they could achieve better results. So for me, private letters demonstrate how much refugees relied on each other in their exile. They were using their connections back from the Caucasus who helped them in exile. And these are the kinds of things that we rarely see in the state archive. But going back to your question about cultural and religious identities and how they changed in exile. Well, in that chapter, I talk about this fascinating place, Uzun Yayla, one of my favorite places in the world. Uzun Yayla is in Turkish means the long plateau. It's this mountain valley in the middle of Anatolia, in the middle of Turkey. It is surrounded by mountains on all four sides. It's very high, it's over 5,000 feet. And in the 1860s, it became one of the most popular places of North Caucasian refugee resettlement. There were about 40,000 refugees in this mountain valley in the middle of Anatolia, and they were pretty much alone on this plateau. There were over 70 villages that refugees established: Kabardian, Western Circassian, Ossetian, Abazin, Chechen, and Karachay. So in a way, it became the Little Caucasus, right? It was the reconstruction of the Caucasus, or more specifically of Circassia, right? And in Turkish today, it's still known as Küçük Kafkasya, Small Caucasus.
Interesting.
And in places like that, where people settled close to each other, they could really preserve their cultural identities and even produce new cultural heritage. There were new songs, new dances, new anecdotes that were very specific to this mountain valley. It's a very vibrant cultural place. And in the last 20 years, there were quite a few expeditions by ethnographers from the Circassian republics in Russia to study the language and the traditions, how they were preserved in the middle of Turkey. But in other places where refugees didn't live in compact communities, it was, of course, much harder to preserve their heritage. And Turkification has been incredibly strong over the 20th century. Between 1923 and the 1950s, many North Caucasians in Turkey feared speaking their languages in public in the cities or expressing their non-Turkish identities because there was specific Kemalist legislation, there was state-sanctioned discrimination against non-Turkish identities. So Turkification has been really strong. And today there are very few places in Turkey where younger generations of North Caucasians will still be growing up speaking Circassian or Chechen. Like, they still exist, like Uzun Yayla, and it's actually remarkable that 150 years later, the sense of cultural identity is so strong in the diaspora, right? But the loss of language in most places is a very serious concern in the North Caucasian diaspora, in Turkey, and in the Arab world.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think while we historians often kind of prefer to anchor our discussions firmly in the past, it's fascinating to me. And I think I do want to trace the threads of history to the present a little bit. And in the case of North Caucasian refugees and kind of their resettlement in the Ottoman Empire, these historical movements, as you've said, have undoubtedly left their mark on contemporary societies. How do you see the legacy of North Caucasian diaspora in today's Middle East? I mean, how do historical refugee movements you've studied inform our understanding of contemporary refugee crises and their legacies?
Right. So I think what is critical here is that we're talking about the North Caucasian diaspora, right? And I want to unpack that. Because when refugees arrived in the Ottoman Empire, they came from different communities in the mountains. They spoke different languages of the Caucasus. They often didn't know each other. For many refugees, they only met other subgroups of Circassians or Chechens or Dagestanis in diaspora, in exile. And so the first generation was really focused on survival. Refugees were scattered throughout the Middle East and the Balkans, primarily in the countryside. There was very little attention to what we could call diaspora building. But then everything changes in the early 20th century. There's the Ottoman Revolution of 1908, which is a very exciting time in the empire. The revolution promises legal equality, the government's accountability, and it ends censorship on political associations. So after 1908, we have new ethnic organizations throughout the empire for Bosnians, Albanians, Jews, Armenians, Bulgarians, and North Caucasians. We have this association that is being established, the Circassian Union and Support Association, in 1908. And it becomes the main diasporic organization that really molds the notion of the North Caucasian diaspora. And it proved incredibly influential for North Caucasian society in the Middle East today. Many fundamentals of ethnic identification, of ethno-national politics, were formulated by this organization before World War I. Because after World War I, as I mentioned, everything shut down, right? All the North Caucasian organizations were disbanded. You could not have an organization with Circassian or North Caucasian in its name. So they had a pretty limited, they had 15 years. The association invested time and effort in formulating a diasporic identity. And they came up with a three-part identity. First, it promoted pride in the ethnicity, in the ethnic Circassian or Chechen or Abkhazian identity. Second, they promoted pride in the national Ottoman identity. Everyone were Ottoman citizens, and they had to be proud of it and contribute to the goodness of the nation. And the third one was the belonging to the global Muslim community. So the Muslim identity was very important. And so this three-part identification, three-part affiliation, pretty much guided how North Caucasian minorities articulated their politics in the post-Ottoman world, in independent Syria, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Israel. Another important thing that the association did was formulate one identity that would unite all these different refugees from the Caucasus. And at first, the association promoted the notion of Circassian identity. So I think for many people in the Middle East, whether Turkey or the Arab world, most of those refugees would be known as Circassians, even though there's such a, you know, such a massive ethnic diversity there. But Circassians were the majority of refugees, and the association made that choice to promote the idea of, you know, Cherkess as an identity. But even that identity needed a lot of articulation, because people came from different groups. Shapsug, Abzakh, Natuhai, Kabardzian. Formulating one identity for them was important. And of course, for them, there was also the sense of the Adige and the Adige Habze that they brought with them to the Ottoman Empire. That was the basis of the Circassian identity. Then during World War I, the association promoted the sense of North Caucasian identity, a pan-ethnic identity based on common regional origin. And again, it was not immediately obvious to most refugees, and it needed to be articulated. So that's as far as the establishment of the North Caucasian diaspora goes. Like, that all happened right before and then shortly after World War I.
That is fascinating. And I think it's it really draws this massive way of negotiating identities, categorizing or reshaping or restructuring these experiences, especially as they resonate through today's cultural and national narratives that you've described. And it reminds us of the kind of lasting impact of historical migrations on modern identities and communities. Speaking of lasting impacts and kind of the way stories are visually represented, I am drawn to the striking cover of your book. It is beautiful. It's gorgeous. And if you haven't seen this book, you should definitely buy it. It's gorgeous. And it's not only visually captivating, but it also seems to encapsulate so much of what we've been discussing. Could you share with us the story behind the cover design? How does it reflect the themes and stories within the pages of your book?
The cover is incredible, and I'm so incredibly grateful to the artist, Jordanian Circassian artist Zainai Said, and also to Stanford University Press for making this happen. So I've been following Zainai's work for many years on Instagram, and then when the time came for me to think about the cover, I noticed this incredible image on Zainai Said's Instagram, and I messaged her and I put her in touch with Stanford University Press, and they made the magic happen. And then, as that was happening, I found out that when I was doing field work in Jordan, so 10 years ago, I was interviewing a lot of people about the experiences of their families, and I actually interviewed a group of people, including the artist's mother. So essentially, it's a perfect circle. This research started with the Circassian refugee community in Jordan, and with this gorgeous cover, it also ends there.
Beautiful.
But you asked me about the themes. So the central image, you see the Circassian man, and Zeyna is a collage artist. So it's a collage of different historical photographs and also of art. And I think the military is a kind of a fascinating theme to follow up on.
Mm-hmm.
Also thinking about your previous question about the diaspora today and the legacy of diaspora in the 20th century mm-hmm. Middle East. So why is the military important? After 1878, after the Russo-Ottoman War, the Ottoman government allowed North Caucasian refugees to join the regular army. It was a very popular career choice because most refugees were settled in the countryside. Their options were either farming or the military, and the latter was more lucrative. And so from that point onward, generations of Circassian men would build a career in the Ottoman military. By the time of World War I, many had high ranks in the army and the security apparatus. That all is important because when the Ottoman Empire collapsed, some of these military men emerged as leaders of their communities, and they were forging new relations with the Turkish National Movement, eventually the Turkish Republican Movement, with the British mandatory authorities in Jordan, with the Hashemite dynasty in Jordan, with the French authorities in Syria. And what they could offer in that critical period, 1920s, was loyalty of their communities, which were very self-conscious about being minorities in all those new nation states, and also military expertise, which was often accepted by the new governments. So that's why the stereotype is that the Circassian diaspora had been pretty well represented in the military and security apparatus, especially in Jordan and in Syria. But that is not random, right? That's very much the legacy of the diaspora's relationship with the Ottoman state and really the nature of Ottoman refugee resettlement. So the central image on the book cover, right, of a Circassian man in kind of a military attire,
right,
very much speaks to that theme, to the importance of the military in the Ottoman resettlement, and of course to the Circassian national costume, right, mm-hmm. from the Caucasus.
I think this book truly stands out as like this remarkable contribution to our understanding of refugee identities, the creation of refugee categories, and their profound impact on imperial migration policies. It's a must read for anyone interested in these complex dynamics that you have beautifully unwrapped in this interview. And we've been incredibly fortunate to have Vladimir Hamid Trojansky with us today, sharing his deep expertise and unique insights. And as we near the end of our conversation, Vladimir, I'd like to pose the traditional question we ask all our guests here at the New Books Network podcast. What's next for you? Could you give us a sneak peek to your upcoming project or what you're currently exploring? I mean, our listeners are always eager to hear about what's in the horizon from our esteemed guests.
Thank you so much. So I'm continuing to work on Muslim refugee migration. And right now I'm writing a global history of Hijra. I'm continuing to explore the phenomenon of Hijra, how it relates to Muslim displacement in the 19th and 20th centuries. And Hijra came to describe so many migrations and displacements in the modern age. Within this project, I'm looking mm-hmm. at mass displacements from the Caucasus and Central Asia and from the Balkans and South Asia. I spent the last two summers collecting archival evidence in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan for this new project, because so many Muslims from Soviet Central Asia fled to Afghanistan, Iran, and Xinjiang in the 1920s and 1930s. So continuing to explore Hijra, I'm interested in bridging Islamic history and global refugee and migration studies, and also putting refugee mobility in the former Russian Empire and the Soviet Union in conversation with developments in the Middle East and the rest of the Muslim world. Aruki, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much. And thank
That
you to the listeners.
sounds absolutely fascinating. We wish you all the best in your future endeavors. And I, along with our listeners, eagerly anticipate reading and hearing more about your work. Thank you, Vladimir, once again for being here.
Thank you so much.
And once again, I'm Aruki Vrankazy, and you've been listening to our discussion with Vladimir Hamet Trojansky about his insightful new book, Empire Refugees, North Caucasian Muslims in the Late Ottoman State. Thank you all for tuning in, wishing you a wonderful week ahead, and stay curious and keep exploring the stories that shape our world. Goodbye for now.